Father O'Malley, what can you tell us about Pope Celestine V, who we've heard so much about over the last few days?
Well, he was elected by a group of 12 cardinals in 1294 after a conclave that went on for over 2 years. And he was a compromise. They went outside the conclave. He was a hermit and a holy man. And they wanted to elect a holy man. They were proud of themselves for having done so. But he was totally unequal to the job. I mean, he could barely read Latin. He was overwhelmed by, he'd never had any administration. He was overwhelmed by everything. And he almost became the prisoner of the King of Naples, Charles of Anjou. So he never set foot in Rome. He spent all his time in Naples. And so there was a lot of unrest in the among the cardinals. And finally, on December the 13th, 1294, he resigned. Was he under pressure? Some people would argue that the cardinals really were applying pressure to him to resign. But I think one could say that it's pretty close to a free resignation, if not altogether free.
There's some discussion recently that his resignation, I mean, for example, supposedly Dante cited him in the Inferno and consigned him to hell for this action.
Well, here's the thing. There was at the time this big discussion, can a pope resign? I mean, the resignation was sort of suspect in some quarters, and Dante did not at all like Celestine's successor, Boniface VIII. And so he put Celestine in hell because of il gran rifiuto, the great refusal, his refusal to accept his responsibility. And his refusal paved the way for Boniface VIII to become pope. So that's sort of the background for Boniface. I mean, for Celestine, however, when about 20 years later, he was canonized. So he is Saint Celestine the Fifth. This was done by the successor to Boniface VIII. So it's a big back and forth with poor old Celestine.
So had public opinion shifted that quickly about him and his
Well,
pages?
No, it was actually a lot of pressure. The Clement the Fifth, who was elected, he was not a cardinal. He was very difficult conclave. He was Archbishop of Bordeaux and was French, never quite got to Rome, and was under great pressure by the King of France to posthumously depose Boniface VIII and denounce him, and as a kind of sop to the King of France, canonized Celestine. So it's a very complicated story.
Now, the other pope that's been cited recently, Gregory the Seventh. What were the circumstances that led to his resignation?
Gregory the Sixth.
Sixth, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, that was the poor bishop of Rome during the 10th century and into the 11th century had fallen. The bishopric had fallen into the hands of local nobles. So it was at its very, very lowest ebb of papal pontificates. So the what had happened was he was Benedict the Ninth was seems to have been duly elected, but was again very unworthy of the office. He made a lot of enemies, very licentious life, and finally was persuaded to resign. But resign for an exchange of money. So the next pope was Gregory the Seventh, or Gregory the Sixth, I'm sorry. And so there's a question about whether he was really legitimately the pope, because his election, one could argue, was done through simony. Then a third person, so you had Benedict the Ninth, you had Gregory the Sixth on the scene, and then all at once out of the woodwork comes a man named Sylvester the Third, who also was claiming to be pope. So you had three popes. And that was settled by a synod that, in effect, deposed them all. So, yes, Benedict the Ninth's resignation seems to have been free, but not really legitimate, not really above board, not really moral, not really ethical.
So that's why we're hearing some different names here from the media, is because it's unclear who actually was forced to resign who did it willingly because it was so infrequent.
Yeah, so I mean, I can count 9 or 10 potential things that look like that are somehow or other papal resignations, but just how many of them were really free is questionable. I mean, you can argue one way or the other in so many of these cases.
Well, as you talk, and you also wrote back in 2005 when we had the last conclave, that there's a lot of intrigue surrounding these conclaves. Was it because, I mean, this was such an important political role as well as a religious role, that's why their people were vying for power in this way?
Yes, it was not only simply a religious role and political, it also had a lot of economic and social benefits for the
sure.
person. So you could, once you became pope, you really had disposition of all the resources of the Roman Church, which were considerable. So, and then you could ennoble your family, and this was so it was a prize that was you had a lot of unworthy people vying for it because, for unworthy reasons. So there have been, ever since the conclave came into existence in 1274, there have been reforms. So. And we've seen some in the last 40 years or so, not major ones, but tinkering with the process.
Now, you write in your piece for America that there were some major reforms back in the 19th century because there were still, I guess, some secular rulers who had some, say, some veto power over the conclave?
Right. That had developed in the 17th century when the great powers, namely great Catholic powers, namely Spain, France, and the Holy Roman Empire, all began to claim that they had they could veto one candidate, and so they had a veto power over a candidate, and they exercised it. Somebody who was unfavorable to them for some reason or another. And the last time, as you know, that was exercised was in 1903, at the time when Pius X was elected, the Roman Emperor, that is to say, was in Vienna, vetoed Cardinal Rampolla, and that was really the end. The cardinals were furious, and they made it absolutely impossible that to happen again. And then the political situation in Europe changed dramatically with the First World War, so it just kind of disappeared.
Now, of course, the intrigue, we haven't seen anything like this over the last century since, as you say, 1903. It doesn't seem like a coincidence that once the political state of the Vatican was less powerful, that these intrigues kind of, there weren't any.
That's right. You know, that the seizure of the Papal States and then of Rome in 1870 changed everything. And the popes no longer had any kind of temporal rule except over the small little city-state. So that did change everything. And we've seen nothing. None of these became much, it was not a political ploy at all in terms of the nation-states and so forth that we have today.
Now, you mentioned some of these recent changes. These are just, as you said, tinkering, a kind of minor
right,
changes.
Right, yes, minor changes. I mean, who can vote? I mean, this whole age issue, how old do you, can you be elected pope after you're 80 and all those sorts of things. So they're really, I think every pope since, certainly Pius XII made changes. I think John the 23rd did, certainly Paul the 6th did, John Paul the 2nd did, and Benedict the 16th has. So there you go.
Well, Father O'Malley, thank you for illuminating some of this history for us, and we look forward to some of your continuing commentary for America.
Okay, thank you very much.